Thank you all for coming. My name's David Rupert, and I'd just like to acknowledge my advisor, Brian Needleman from the University of Maryland, other professors at the University of Maryland, but also Peter Kleinman of USDA ARS, who have all helped me with this, which is part of my PhD project. So, and I should actually...
Can I go back?
I should mention the title. Simulating the effects of dredged and controlled drainage on phosphorus storage in field ditches. So what we're looking at here, we're looking at drainage ditches on the eastern shore of Maryland. The mesocosms that I used for my experiment were gathered from the University of Maryland Research, University of Maryland Eastern Shore Research Farm, though the research occurred at the University of Maryland College Park inside a greenhouse. And what we're looking at here is we're looking at natural ways to manipulate ditches and see, can we get them to retain more phosphorus, you know, through manipulating them somehow. So due to their proximity to agricultural fields and the fact that they function as primary interception points for groundwater, ditches should be seen as integral to nutrient management. Ditches have complex biogeochemistry, and that depends at the time on just how saturated that ditch soil is. A ditch could function like a stream. It could function like a wetland. It could function like an upland, depending on how high that water table is. And, of course, biogeochemistry is terribly complicated. Now, here's an interesting case. Rather simple. This is from a drainage ditch that's from the University of Maryland Eastern Shore. Not the drainage ditch where I got my mesocosms from, but it's not that far away. And what's interesting about this soil profile are the colors. You can see that there is a layer of pyrite here. These are marine sediments. So we have unoxidized pyrite that's been in place for tens of thousands of years. And there was a ditch dug just above it. It happens to be especially close to the surface at this place in the landscape. And there are portions of that pyrite that are being oxidized now. So we're developing these iron oxides. And that's good stuff for us because we know that iron oxides sorb phosphorus. And, of course, there's a type of iron oxide that sorbs phosphorus better than any other. Those are paracrystalline iron oxides. So one question we could ask is, if we manipulate hydrology of a drainage ditch, can we transform crystalline iron oxides to paracrystalline iron oxides and increase our phosphorus retention? Now, one way that you can measure paracrystalline iron oxides is through the oxalate extraction. So we'll see that in a little while. You know, a common ditch intervention is to clean ditches out with a backhoe. So I don't think I have time after all to talk about some of these references here. But here we have a backhoe scooping out a drainage ditch about just a few miles away from our University of Maryland Eastern Shore site. And you can see that they're getting the O horizon, the A horizon, and the C horizons that are below. Just everything is coming out. And so one question you can ask is, what's the difference in functioning between a cleaned-out ditch and a ditch that has not been cleaned out? Sometimes the word dredge is used, but I'll be using the word clean-out for today. You know, another way to manipulate ditches is to manipulate the water table by simply backing the ditch up using some riser boards put into a water control structure. Now, that's the water control structure that's on the left. On the right, it's just a flume. The problem is that I didn't have a good high-resolution picture of a water control structure, so that flume is kind of filling in for a water control structure. So what effect do water control structures have on ditch biogeochemistry, and what happens to that iron? Does it get reduced? And what happens to the phosphorus that's attached to that iron? Does it get released? And lastly, so we've talked about four things. We've talked about the fact that there's iron in ditch soils, and the type of iron might matter. Can we, by manipulating the water table, get ourselves a type of iron that's most friendly to sorbing phosphorus? Ditches are also managed by cleanouts. They're managed by water control structures. But also there's a huge gradient in organic matter and iron and phosphorus from the top of a ditch soil down to the sea horizons below. So I've got some data here for you. You can just see how iron drops and phosphorus drops a lot and organic matter drops as you go down from organic horizons through mucky horizons and down to sea horizons. Now, this is not a mucky delta. That should say mucky A. But the way that it shows up on my laptop is a little different than the way that it shows up on my computer. And there's another slide coming up where we're constrained that way too, but this should say mucky A. So this is the experiment that we came up with as a result of all that. Now, the number of replicates for our experimental units are given here by the numbers that are not in parentheses. The numbers in parentheses are the subset of those experimental units that we hooked up with redox instrumentation, platinum electrodes and some pore water samplers for pH. I won't be talking about the redox data today. So this is our replication. And then this is a cross-factorial, so we've got hydraulic treatments and we've got soil treatments. What we decided to do with our mesocosms is we decided to keep some of them saturated the whole duration of the experiment. Others were drained as much as we could keep them during the experiment. And then others fluctuated between saturated and drained states, kind of in order, depending. We also had soil treatments. One of the treatments was to gather mesocosms from a ditch that had been cleaned out. But what we also did was we gathered mesocosms from that same ditch before that clean-out occurred. And what we did to them was some we left alone. Others we took some of that highly reactive, highly concentrated material with iron and phosphorus in it, and we added some of it to the mesocosms that we gathered. Another treatment was to take about 2 centimeters of that superficial material, whatever it was, O horizon, mucky A horizon, and we took it away. So this is our treatment structure. Another thing we've got to do is because these are ditches, water's got to get into them and get out. So we added water to them. We added water not from above but from below to simulate the rise of the water table. So we did that by having water in Marriott bottles, adding it to the bottom of the mesocosm, and then having the water rise through the mesocosm and come out through an effluent port. Here was the chemistry of our input water. We decided on our chemistry through looking at some publications that had been produced from the UMES site, but also from some grab samples. We used this amount of milligrams per liter of phosphorus as input. And this is not... this is my bad. This is not 0.48 milligrams of phosphate per liter, but 0.48 milligrams of P per liter. All these others are as listed. There's a lot of sulfate, you might be wondering, in our input water, probably because of that pyrite that sits just below some of these ditches. So if you're wondering why that huge sulfate number, I think that's why. So to preclude preferential flow in our mesocosms, we dried them out, and then we added this paraffin around the side to try to minimize preferential flow as much as we could. This is what the experiment looked like inside the greenhouse at the University of Maryland College Park. The experimental units were arranged in a completely randomized design. This is the timeline of the experiment, and here is the other offending parts here that are obscured. It should say upwelling, upwelling number one, upwelling number two, upwelling number three. The upwellings is when we added water to the bottom of our mesocosms to simulate the rise of groundwater. So before the experiment, all of the mesocosms were in a drained state. The experiment began when we added water to the bottom of the mesocosms to simulate a rise of the water table. That water was collected out the top, and we analyzed it for phosphorus. After that upwelling that lasted just a few days, we went into different equilibration periods. The saturated mesocosms from then on were continuously saturated. The drained mesocosms were drained after each upwelling, and then we had the alternating treatment that was either saturated or drained in order. So now let's look at some data. The Let's look at individual horizons and let's look at the relationship between phosphorus and iron in our individual mesocosm horizons. It's a nice tight relationship between phosphorus and iron, and this is oxalate extractable iron of individual soil horizons here. Oxalate extractable phosphorus and iron. Nice relationship. Not as tight with aluminum. So this is really an iron-dominated soil as far as the behavior of the phosphorus goes. And notice here, 40 millimoles of aluminum per kilogram, whereas for iron we have 800 millimoles of iron per kilogram. So we've just got tons and tons of iron in this iron-dominated system. If you're interested in DPS, which is the ratio of oxalate extractable phosphorus to iron and aluminum, as was mentioned, not in the previous talk, but in the talk before, we're starting at about maybe 25 or so DPS and moving on up from there. So these are soils that are pretty saturated as far as phosphorus goes and are capable of leaching phosphorus pretty easily. So let's now look at whole mesocosm soil. Let's look at the effect of cleanouts. This isn't groundbreaking results here. When you clean ditches out, you remove the horizons that contain all that iron and phosphorus and aluminum. But what's more interesting to ask is, what's the effect of these different hydrology states on our mesocosm? So here we're looking at whole mesocosms, the ones that we had before they were cleaned out. And let's ask, what happens with hydrology? Well, one of the things we were expecting is that for our alternating treatment, maybe we would be taking some crystalline iron oxides and turning them into paracrystalline oxides. And therefore, when we measure the oxalate extractable iron, we would get increased oxalate extractable iron from our mesocosms that had that alternating treatment relative to the drain treatment. Well, that didn't happen. We didn't grow more paracrystalline iron. It looks like what we had in there to begin with is what we got. However, for the saturated treatments, we lost iron as a result of saturation. I don't have a picture of it, but oftentimes the effluent water coming out of a mesocosm would be orange in color. I think what happened was it would be somewhat clear and then become orange within a few minutes. I think what was happening is we had reduced iron inside our saturated mesocosms, and it was oxidizing outside in our effluent bottles. So we lost iron in our saturated treatments, we lost phosphorus, and we lost aluminum too. That was looking at soil. Now let's look at the effluent water that we had. The hydrology by soil, by time interaction was not significant. So thank the Lord I don't have the three-way graph that I have to show you. But unfortunately, the two-way interactions were significant. So I have to show those to you. So they're a little bit more complicated. But what we're looking at here isn't meant to be, but we don't have to make it too complicated. The take-home message here as far as the effluent water goes, this is not really too much of a surprise. The drained mesocosms, so these are the very small dots, the drained mesocosms never released that much phosphorus. Now, of course, if you want to avoid eutrophication, you need to have something like 0.03 milligrams of phosphorus per liter or less in your water. So we're way above eutrophication thresholds here. But nonetheless, we're still way below the amount that was coming out of the saturated mesocosms. You can see the alternating treatment behaved either like it was like they were drained or whether they were saturated, depending on where they were in the cycle. If we look at the effect of our pedology or our soil treatments, it's also kind of complicated, but the thing to notice here is that the clean-out mesocosms all released less phosphorus than did the non-clean-out mesocosms. This next graph is a little bit redundant. We've already seen hydrology by time and soil by time, so I'm not gonna mention this one. Plus, I think I'm running out of time. Now, this is an interesting table here. The previous graphs that we've seen have been comparing effluent phosphorus among the treatments. Here we're comparing effluent of here's our effluent values for our different treatments, but we're comparing them against the value of our input water. So all of these comparisons here, these p-values, are for these values given our standard errors against our input value. And for all of the pre-cleanout treatments, that we got a lot more phosphorus out, and it's significantly different. For our cleanout treatments, sometimes we got less, sometimes we got more, but we can't see anything statistically significantly different. However, we had limited replication here. So that's kind of too bad. It would be nice to know what would happen if we actually had more replication. So some basic conclusions. Saturation resulted in the loss of iron and phosphorus in our effluent. Saturation. What did alternating the hydrology do? Well, it didn't do anything. We weren't able to increase our phosphorus sorption capacity by changing by that alternating treatment. I think probably what that means is that all of our iron that's inside our soils was probably paracrystalline to begin with. And Ugo Schwertmann in 1966 inspected a ditch in Germany. And now these are some treatments that he did. These are treatments that he did to that soil once he got it. But he found that in his ditch soil, all of it was amorphous, all of the iron. So it could be that the ditches simply have a lot of they simply grow paracrystalline iron and retain it. It never becomes crystalline in ditches. Another conclusion would be that no treatment was able to significantly lower effluent P below input P. One of the cleanout treatments did do that, but it wasn't statistically significant. I've got the star there because of that. Now, I've got some speculation here. We can try to go through it really fast. It might be hard to hydraulically tweak ditch soils to become better p-sorbers. I think that ditch soils, in the first place, are really good at generating paracrystalline iron, and they're really good at keeping it from becoming crystalline. They've got a lot of phosphorus and organic matter, and that was shown in a paper by Schwertmann in 1991 to really preclude the development of paracrystalline to becoming crystalline iron oxides. Another speculative result here might be that in heavily manured landscapes, reliance on natural ditch processes, you know, that's all the treatments that we had in our experiment. They were all kind of natural, you know, relying on natural function of soils. Reliance on natural ditch processes to lower phosphorus below eutrophication levels, it doesn't seem to be possible in the soils that we have. So what could you do? Could you clean out frequently, because it was that one clean that what that we did have that one clean out treatment that with that really low replication that did give us an average that was below. We'd have to explore that more. But bravo to those folks that are examining the use of artificial materials, p-sorbing materials. What we have in our heavily manured landscapes is we have an industrial landscape. We're applying manure at an industrial level. What we've got to do is we have to have some kind of industrial cleanup process. We can't rely on natural systems to do more work than they really can. I think I'm out of time. So I'll take a question if there is any time or afterwards.
Wait after.
Yes. Please. Very good. Thank you.